an example that we shared with you during the year of IDC funded films that were made in South Africa. And they range from iconic movies about the country, but increasingly also we're becoming a place where foreign films are shot on location in South Africa. This is the Skyring studio, and it's just an example that we shared with the committee during the year, where IDC investment is not only about building steel mills and fertilizer plants, but also helping create the infrastructure where we can tell our own story as a country. And in this case, because the location is the top of the Carlton in Joburg, it's also an urban renewal, brings life and economic activity to inner Joburg, and it builds African infrastructure in the sense that television companies elsewhere in the continent are now seeking to contract with the studio in Joburg, so we can then get some of the business on the continent. Another example is the BIC, the Beijing Auto Industrial Corporation, and this just shows the relationship between policy, advocacy, and investment. So in 2009, with the global economic crisis, the NGP was adopted. It pointed to the fact that we can't keep on being an exporter of raw materials. At about the same time, there was a state visit to China. We then inserted a paragraph in the agreement between the People's Republic of China and the Republic of South Africa that identified the need for China to invest in South Africa rather than to sell products to South Africa. In 2014, the IDC started exploratory talks with BIC. In 2015, President Xi visited South Africa and signed an agreement between BIC and the IDC. And in August this last year, there was a sod turning. And there's now been, the foundations have been laid of the company. And we expect that when it's completed, it would be the first new light passenger vehicle assembly plant. So it's taken step by step, using a state visit, a policy issue, an instrument like the IDC, working with DTI on their incentive packages, bringing all of that together successfully is really what economic development often is about. Let's just provide some information. Looking at the IDC and the work we've done, a big part of our job is to focus the IDC on this number. How to increase overall funding every year. And it's an ongoing challenge for the IDC because it says to us, when the economy slows down, we don't have new projects. We need to cut down our targets. We say to them, when the economy slows down, that's precisely when an IDC needs to step up. And economists call it counter-cyclical investment. It's that you invest against the economic cycle, so that you stimulate growth and you don't get the economy to go into a deep recession. Some of the other areas, increase in youth empowered business funding, quite massive, women empowered funding and jobs. Now, honorable members will recall, a number of years ago, I think it's chair perhaps 3 years ago, in the budget speech of economic development, we set the target on youth investment by the IDC. Now, you make the announcement in, let's say, April or May in the budget book. The IDC then has to take that work in the next corporate plan. They put the numbers in, they tune up. Initially, they'll fumble a little bit, they won't get it absolutely right, they learn from the experience, they improve it. Eventually, the program begins to run. By now, the program is running, and you can see on a year-to-year basis, 142% increase. So whether they can sustain that is going to be an important challenge for the institution. But that, for me, is an example that when you make the announcement, You can't see something immediately, but eventually, again, if you persevere, you monitor, you focus on that area, then it begins to translate into a positive story. Similarly with women empowered businesses. Yeah, it was quite an unusual increase, very welcome increase, probably one that the IBC will struggle to sustain because it's a mature program, but very pleasing that we could announce that. Big increase also in the number of jobs created to save. We were worried that the IBC job numbers were not as strong as it needed to be. Lots of focus on that between the department and the IBC in the year, and it's helped to lift the jobs numbers. There you see the transactions involving black industrialists and the increase in both black-owned and black-empowered business funding. By black-empowered, what we mean is a company where at least 25% of the ownership is in the hands of black South Africans. Black-owned is where at least 50% of the ownership is in the hands of black South Africans. So the department has pulled together an interesting slide here, looking at the BEE transaction value that was facilitated by the work that economic development did. You see 10.1 billion rand approvals by the IBC for BEE-empowered companies, an estimated 5 billion rand value of the construction industry deal, 2 billion rand component to the Coca-Cola merger, and a 1.8 billion rand component to the ArcelorMittal BEE partnership. So these are quite significant numbers, and if we can get each of them working well, they will have their challenges, and if we can get them working well, you get real meaningful transformation in the economy that combines both commercial rationale, in other words, these things make sense in the market, and also political rationale, that they reflect the fact that in the South African political economy, ownership must be broad-based and ownership must include more than just nominal 5%, 10% stakes in the company. You've got to bring black South Africans into driving significant enterprises in the economy. On the IBC investment in provinces, we thought that honourable members may find some of this interesting. There are positive stories, there are challenging stories. So you see in Gauteng a significant increase in the number of jobs, from 1,700 jobs to 6,300 jobs. On the other hand, if we look at, say, a province like Northwest, you'll see it was basically flat, the job creation, and you take a province like Limpopo, you'll see that there's been a decline in the number of new jobs that has been created. So it's a big story because it depends on projects that are coming in a given year. If you've got a great year and you approve a big project, your numbers shoot up. Then it may take another 2 or 3 years before you have another great project. So the next couple of years, your numbers look really down, but it's because this is the nature of investment. Economists call it, they say, lumpy. It doesn't come in a smooth flow, but you want to look at the overall trend line with investment. In the report, there are lots of details of work the department has done to fast track or unblock the opportunities in the economy. And I must say, even though it's a very small team in the department that does it, as my DG always reminds me, that it's a tiny team, they do quite exceptional work and very concrete ways of illustrating it. Calibri Textiles, for example, is the company that does these towels that that we use in our homes. And we introduced them to Massmart, who required a local supply of space towels for game. They received support from the Massmart supplier grant. Where does that grant fund come from? The competition settlement or a directive of the courts. As a result of the court case we took on. That in turn helped them to buy 30 industrial sewing machines, and they're looking at 30 new jobs to be created. or the impact water license, where a company could expand its operation, but it needed a water license for a factory in the Pieter Retief area, and we helped to unblock the challenge, which will support the 60 million rand plant upgrade. These examples, I mean, some of these are very interesting little examples. There's a program called Working for Water. An honorable chairperson, you may recall that the late Professor Kada Asmal, who was passionate about whatever he was doing, and when he did water, he was very passionate about water, and he pioneered a new way of thinking about all the programs, and he brought in something that's almost like an EPWP in our modern day language, called Work for Water. There's some really committed South Africans working on that program, people like Guy Preston and others, and they basically combat alien vegetation that sucks water out of our water system. And so we've been working with them, and eventually as we did work with Massmart, we asked Massmart, would you buy furniture from a state entity? And they said, yes, of course we would. And we went to the state entity and we said, would you sell our furniture to Massmart? And they scratched their head and they say, yeah, of course. But they weren't set up for this. So they didn't have the ability to invoice properly. They were almost like an NGO, and just helping them a little bit through that. We got furniture into the macro stores, and it helped us sustain jobs in that program. Now, can we scale those kind of things up? That's going to be the interesting question. We've previously reported on the IFL steel matter. There's an example, a few other examples that we put there. Let me take the example of ArcelorMittal in Duferco. I received a letter from Duferco saying that they feel very unhappy, they want to have a rebate so that they can import steel, that they don't think ArcelorMittal can supply them, and certainly if it can supply them, it won't be at the right price. And there was a bit of, let's call it, customer-supplier tension in that relationship. And just by working with the parties, we got to the point where they reached an agreement and Duferco agreed to buy all of its hot rolled coil from AMSA Saldanha Mill, displacing 24 tons of imported hot rolled coil per month. So that's a significant little example of how you just lubricate commercial relationships and ensure that you get this. So there isn't a magic wand where we could make an announcement and everything happens. It's in this detail that things get unblocked. Building an inclusive economy, some of the work of EDD is to work with provinces to promote economic development. Deputy Minister leads our work there, and he has had an opportunity to share some of that with the committee, promoting black farmer participation in the agro-processing value chain, using competition policies to bring new players into the economy, or support black industrialists, ensuring trade policy saves jobs and industries, ensuring that we focus on youth employment and entrepreneurship, broaden ownership in the economy through investment opportunities, and partner with local stakeholders. Now, each of these are general points, but sitting under it are interesting examples of the kind of work we do to broaden participation in the economy. I'll just point to a few, but we've also shared other examples in the course of the year. So, the Deputy Minister, for example, calls that the Youth Entrepreneurial Dialogue with the National Youth Chamber in the Gertsibandi area. He was also actively involved in the Steve Shwete municipality with the promotion of steel and metal fabrication hub, and signed an MOU with the Kerkverband in Tibet College in Sasol. So those are three examples, very local, but with quite a significant impact that it can and does have in local economies. Another example, perhaps wider than a locality, is our work to align ACTs to national economic policy in areas like Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and Northwest. Here is an example of the work that we've done. There's a picture there that you can see highlighting the signing of the MOU. On youth employment, we provide some information on consultations we've had, research, working with government departments and the presidency, completing the youth employment accord, and developing proposals for a second version of the support. The accord has had some very positive effects, but also some challenges, and it's to identify what we can do in a new period. Then we've done some work in local areas. We can use the example of Mbombela or Cape of Dallas or Saldana, but here we've given the example of Sutherland, where we did a ministerial visit as part of a potential astronomy corridor between Sutherland and Carnarvon. Following that, we got SARS and CIFRA CEDA to go to this little area, and they received support. We got some of them registered, some of the businesses registered for tax. We got them in a position where they could tender for procurement by the municipality. And there's an observatory in the area, a very large telescope, the largest in the southern hemisphere. The shop at the observatory is now selling local goods, and they funded a hostel using local businesses and a science laboratory at the secondary school. Tourism grew, and we've seen a bit of support in one of the black-owned B&Bs. We did work on farmers, as I indicated earlier, three examples. On the soya farmer side, the EDD team supported a program working with the province that had 38 black farmers in the soya production for the first time to supply local crushing plants. And you see there, that's 2,005 hectares of land under cultivation now. Barley and hops, 800 black farmers will now be supported by the InBev to provide inputs for beer making. And 2,600 workers will be employed over the next 5 years. And in grape production, we brought black farmers into the supply chain in the Northern Cape, and the company Grape Ties moved from 11% local supply to 25% local supply, and they're increasing their target. Here we just wanted to take a big view of inclusion, looking at the IDC over 5 years, 8 billion rand in women-empowered companies and 4 billion rand in youth-empowered companies, and its direct and indirect job impact is about 344,000. We normally, Chairperson, look at direct jobs because the indirect jobs are always a little bit of an estimate, but every so now and then one needs to look at the overall picture, and so we've brought that in here. Signed a MOU with the Government of Flanders and the International Labour Organization. They're bringing 19 million rand to help us do a bit of work on social economy. This word policy should be replaced with economy, social economy framework for South Africa. On the annual performance plan, we had the annual performance plan tabled in Parliament. Honourable members will see there were 23 KPIs. In 13 cases, we achieved our targets. In 10 cases, we exceeded our targets. And in all of the cases, in none of the cases, did we go below the targets. We had 170 products for the frontline work, and we achieved 202. Now, this slide is just the first attempt at grouping together products into different categories. So 87 of our products were reports on the jobs drivers, on the new growth path, on the level of impact with us for funding, many different kinds of reports, on price increases, in administered prices, those kinds of examples. 39 were initiatives on getting youth access to funding, or supporting provinces, or working to improve effective industrial relations through negotiation and network. 31 of them were all the work around coordinating big meetings, the PICC Council, or Management Committee, or sub-coordinators, and so on. 18 were initiatives that entail a degree of ministerial oversight of the IEC, the competition authorities, ITAC, and so on. 4 products were finance and HR related, and we had one conference dealing with economic traders, with informal traders in the economy. The governance and accountability management performance assessment tool, MPACT, is something that's used across different government departments to try to benchmark performance, and we're pleased that we have been able to improve performance in the year taken as a whole. On human resources, we employ staff on a permanent basis as well as through fixed-term contracts with specific projects and secondments to access scarce skills. Now, yeah, one of the big challenges for the new financial year would be to make sure that we complete the appointment of the senior staff. It's an area that is the one deliverable that would be helpful to the long-term stability and performance. The other part is to change the staffing mix so that we're able to access at short notice much more high-level skill, where we can bring in top economists and policy thinkers in the society. We're not cracking that sufficiently. So whether it's on issues of policy towards agriculture, you've got to bring the best thinkers. They may be at one of the universities. They may be in one of the agricultural institutes. So we still have too traditional a model in the department. It was set up like it's a department of prisons or housing or social welfare, with a standard model. And we're now working on this. We've advertised and we're now shortlisting for the senior positions in the department. But one of the things that the DG is doing is a review of our model, the staffing model of the department. On the ratios, we provide information here, 48.5% women in SMS, 20 interns, workplace skills plan was developed, 18 policies were reviewed, 4 of them were approved, and we provide a bit of information here. The employee assistance program was given to an outside service provider. We had an HIV counseling and testing campaign in partnership with a medical aid program. And then DG has put together in the annual report the personal expenditure by program, looking at administration, total spending. You see 90 million, you see the personal spending, you see the training spending, professional services, and so on. So it breaks down an overall view of spending by program. We then provided information in the annual report on personal costs by salary band. And EDD has a significant number of skilled people, more than the average in the public sector. But as I've indicated, we're not always attracting the top thinkers in the field. So our salary bill in relative terms per person is high, but it's not achieving completely what we designed it for, which is to bring your top thinkers in. This provides the committee with a bit of information on the appropriation that committee members would be very familiar with, looking at the appropriation of funds that are then transferred to CIFA, the Commission, the Department, ITAC, and the Tribunal. And honourable members will see the Department only accounts for about 20%, about one-fifth of the total budget that comes through the portfolio. In fact, the exact figure is 22%. For the year as a whole, the department spent 98.6% and we had an unqualified audit opinion. This provides some additional information on overall spending, not just personal spending. The standard by economic classification, these tables are also, of course, in the annual report, and the transfers to entities are put more clearly here. The revenue side is also addressed. The cash received outside of EDD revenue, so previously we had accounted for fines and penalties that the Competition Commission imposed. That would be regarded as revenue. As a result of changes in the accounting methodology, we no longer reflect it as revenue, as EDD revenue, but it still goes to the National Revenue Fund. And we had very good engagements with the Auditor General. They pointed to some challenges and weaknesses in our systems. They pointed to some improvements in our systems. And there was clearly both scope for improvement, but also a recognition that we had improved. The department had improved in some of the areas. So that's a summary of the more detailed report, Chairperson. And I would like to thank you for this opportunity and hand back to you. And Deputy Minister Masuku, no doubt, wants to talk a little bit during the engagement with the committee about some of his own insights in how, at provincial level, all of the big issues that we've dealt with become usable to constituents and to citizens. So thank you very much on behalf of both Deputy Minister and myself and the DG and the team.
Thank you so much, Honourable Minister, for the well-presented annual report summary. It is quite clear that from what you've presented, we know that the importance of establishing this department, the particular department. Very noticeable improvement in as far as the work of the entity. It's clear that without them, we couldn't have unbundled most of the things, and quite noticeably also how we refocus most of their work to ensure that we give noticeable and maximum attention to the areas that were otherwise weak or not noticeable. Also, we've seen the fruits of integrated planning and implementation compared to silo working. Concern remains, though, that the overall impact on jobs and growth is not shown that much. Of course, noting the environment we are operating under, including external factors. The fact of the matter is For growth and total investment, we now rely on government. You can see that through services and all other government is present now with those kind of investments compared to previously where 75% of fixed investment came from the private sector. That is something that we have to note and very, very much worried that the FDP target in terms of fixed investment is not showing and it's not about to be realized at 50% per annum. So, to us, that remains quite a challenge. It will be important also to hear what the DM would be saying around the work of the TVET in as far as skills development is concerned. Who actually, after the deputy minister has gone to provinces, who then monitors and ensures the actual implementation of the MOU signed on behalf of the state, with the private sector and also our institutions. That those were just the words of appreciation, the fact that we are a kind motion. Challenges do not make you run that statement, otherwise they make you even more vigor to achieve what you plan to achieve. That actually motivates us even more. Thank you for that and the work that you've done and you've shown us. Otherwise, I'll open up for members to ask questions. You're welcome, Secretary. Because you know that you'll be late. May I know to you? And then the Secretary. Yes, that's one.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks very much, Minister, for the presentation. I just want to say congratulations on your audit outcomes and meeting your KPIs. And certainly from our side, our concern has never been about the fact that the department's not well run, so congratulations on that. Just want to ask you three questions, really. The first one relates to the one of the early slides you spoke about total 19.9%. Total capital spend as a percentage of GDP. And this is also, I suppose, in line with your involvement in the presidential infrastructure program as well. I was reading an article on yesterday's Business Day, in which there's been a report by a number of engineers on the state of our public infrastructure, what they call public capital. And they were just saying that it actually hasn't been well maintained and that there's a huge concern, obviously, about the state of our public capital, basically things like the dams and roads, just everything to do with public infrastructure. So while I'm saying it's good that we're spending a lot of money on infrastructure investment, what focus is there actually on maintenance? And especially in line with the report we had yesterday, it's important that we build new stuff, but if we're not looking after what we've got, that will have a major effect on economic performance. Then the second point was just, we spoke a lot about the IDC, and obviously it's a major national asset and we want to see it as sustainable as possible. When they reported to us earlier about 6 months ago, we discussed this whole issue of politically exposed persons, and especially their loans to Shiva Uranium. So I'd like to know whether you're having interactions with them, particularly over that particular loan, and whether you are following up on this issue of politically exposed persons, because what we do want to see is the IDC making the right investments in the economy to help grow the economy, and obviously not the effective ability to be able to borrow when loans are not there for the right reasons. And then thirdly, just a referral to the point that you made about the fact that investments in the economy by the private sector has declined and by government has increased slightly. And obviously there's a concern about the political environment at the moment, which seems to be affecting the desire of private companies to make investments in this country. And I think especially when you see what's been going on in the mining industry and just feeling the bad relationship really between the mining minister and the Chamber of Mines.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you, Minister, for the presentation. I hope you feel well. My voice is not coming. The first question, Minister, relates to the PSC project. We know that there are major projects that are going on at the PSC. PSC, the logistics project. So, can you make a few major companies that are involved there and explain to us as to whether they comply with the support of the laws and regulations? That's the first one. Can you tell us what the department is doing to try and assist the ITEC to overcome the problem they're having with the auditor general, the serious issues with misstatements and so forth? And the third question is about your organogram. Has it finally come together, or is it being developed as you employ more people in key positions? And the last one is just a clarity on the allocations to CIFA, whether they are still continuing. Thank you.
Thank you. something which is not part of the cost, which I like to do. We always said in this country that the water is clean in this country. I read this month a part of it. The issue of having the belongings and the
around the water catchments. We are paying for the water catchments for that are established in every district, if I'm not mistaken. They are aiming at militantly, but are they producing what they're supposed to be producing? That's another issue. I wanted to come in also on the issue of the justice. On the state of our infrastructure that appeared in the previous day today. I think that report, when I looked at it, the average of sea, the West, in a scorecard where A was the best and E was the worst. So they said, though, that the average was C. C plus, and when I looked at it, it was C. From what they were saying in terms of that scorecard, to me it was a C plus, but they rated it as C plus. That's, you know, how people do things, but looking at the state of the art of having trouble with the world, I think we are ready to well, except for the social infrastructure and the problem. But anyway, for the minister, because we are this afternoon going to have this report, here is the report on the progress made on our infrastructure development. So I suggest that perhaps the minister can say something, but the whole lot of the full report will be getting later on. Minister, I also have questions, but I don't know whether you should answer this and then we have the second set of questions later on. Let me allow you to, and then we look at our time, if our time permits, for which I think we still have time, we can then continue with the next set of questions. May I hand over to you for now?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. If I could start with the questions posed by Honourable Atkinson. Chair, you've pointed out that this afternoon we will be reporting to a joint committee of Parliament on infrastructure. But I think nonetheless, one issue we can take up front the issue of maintenance that Honourable Atkinson has raised, and Chair, that you've also commented on. Without question, whilst one could look at some of the detail in the SAIKI report, overall, we are not doing enough on infrastructure maintenance, and there are many reasons for it. Some of them good, some of them not so good. And I think part of it is, if I look at the challenges, this afternoon we will provide the other parliamentary committee with an example of road maintenance, where essentially what it will show is that the more you neglect a road in order to save costs, because it costs money to maintain a road, the bigger your bill becomes through the cumulative effect of wear and tear and maintenance challenges. So we will provide that information. Why is there underinvestment in maintenance? Part of it is, in our budget system, when a grant is made, Parliament passes a budget, that money is made available to a department, let's say schools or whatever. A department may be under pressure to build new schools. And in that trade-off, deciding whether to put money into new build or into maintaining the existing schools, officials very often make the decision that they need to respond to the immediate urgent need to build new schools. It's seen as service delivery. Maintenance work is quiet. It's a fixing of a classroom door that's broken, or windows that are broken, or ceiling that has collapsed. And you don't get the recognition in the community that you've done anything if you've just kept the school maintained. But if you stand back from that, it's actually a very bad judgment call that official makes. Because the quality of the existing school stock is critical for the education outcomes. So what we're looking at now is whether there shouldn't be a obligatory, a compulsory ring-fencing of monies for maintenance, that departments and entities can't touch the money for capital bond. They can only use it for maintenance and refurbishment. So that I've given just a little bit on it, but I think maintenance is one of our most serious challenges on infrastructure, and that we ignore it at our peril as a country. The IPC, I think part of, obviously, public comment, I would have to reiterate what I've said previously, which is on the IPC is has now taken a decision that it will release all information about every transaction that it enters into. And I think that that's an important part of bringing light and transparency to the work of public institutions. It comes at a cost. Very often, applicants for funding and ordinary companies got no involvement in any political organization. It's owner may just be an entrepreneur somewhere, they would require the normal confidentiality. But given our history of weak governance on things like tenders, we need to ensure that in all the institutions, the IDC, but all the other institutions, there is greater transparency so we can clean up the problems and the mess that we have in some of the entities. So I hope that the leadership that the IDC board has shown is one that will inspire many other public entities to do the same. Subsequently, the DTI also announced that they will make available, I think once a year, information on the recipients of grants that they give. And I think it brings a healthy transparency. Obviously, we could provide a bit more information on the number of applications, but to help the committee, this is now all put on the website by the IDC. As regards any individual transaction, the IDC has to ensure that it follows every governance process and that the public money is fully protected. That is critical. So in the transaction that Honorable Atkinson pointed to, the mandate of the IDC board will be to ensure that it takes every step that it needs to take to protect public money. On the investment by the private sector,
and what are we doing about it? In the budget vote, we've identified four key things that we need to do to improve investment and the overall investment climate. And honourable members may be able to recall. First one is a credible growth story. So identify opportunities, a bit like what we've shown on here, where the economy can grow, where there's opportunities, like agro-processing. The second one is transformation, because transformation itself can be a source of growth. If you bring young entrepreneurs in, they bring energy and enterprise to the economy. The third one is governance. It's ensuring that investors and the public know that public monies are properly looked after, that tenders are not given on political criteria that has to do with individual families or friends. So it may seem like it's an ethical issue. It is that too, but it's critically an economic issue if you want to restore confidence among citizens, consumers, and investors. And the final one is partnership, working more closely with the business community and labour. Now, of course, the chair pointed out that public investment levels have risen much more sharply than private investment. Part of it is because we've invested a lot more in infrastructure. And in the early 90s, late 80s, infrastructure spending had dropped quite a bit. We'll share that this afternoon, Chairperson, in the committee, some of the trend lines. But the other part is serious long-term investors are affected by market sentiment. They're worried if you're going to put 3 billion rand or 5 billion rand of your money into a project, you want to know that over the next 5 or 10 years that you can predict what will be the policy environment. So the work that we're doing now is to ensure that on all of the key areas we identify more clearly the policy trajectory in the areas economic development is involved in. So with competition, for example, as we made the changes to the Competition Act to introduce the market inquiry and the criminalization provision, we gave the market quite a bit of opportunity to get used to the changes. When we're now looking at changes to the Competition Act that will focus on concentration, we'll have a public debate. We'll invite participation and ensure that there's an understanding in the market. Not always a complete comfort, but an understanding where is the direction that we're going to. So that's on the more narrow area of EDD. But it's unquestionably, and the medium-term budget policy statement is coming up, the budget in February is coming up, those are key moments when investors look to government to provide a steer on the policy environment. The second part of it is the engagement with business directly. I addressed, for example, the annual summit of the Banking Association of South Africa a few weeks ago to talk to bankers about the need for them to invest more robustly in the economy. Because this can be a self-defeating thing. You're worried about policy uncertainty, so you don't invest. That creates more joblessness, more frustration, more protests, more calls for radical measures to deal with that, and so you hold back more. There's got to be confidence by the private sector to invest, which in turn reduces the levels of unemployment, creates more jobs, and stabilizes the political environment. There's got to be more work by us as public authorities to stabilize the policy environment, not to have surprises in the environment, and to provide a more predictable environment for everybody. So it's in that dual responsibility that both the state and the private sector has. I can easily take a knock at the private sector and quote the figures, but I think we've got to solve the problem. And the problem is, how do we get money that's in South Africa, working harder, creating more jobs. We've had some good successes,
at the micro level, you've seen the example. We need to do this on a much wider scale. And that's what I think we want to do in future. Turning next to the question part for Priyani, on the EICC projects, essentially there are hundreds of these projects and they would have construction companies in them, suppliers of metal, cement, manufactured products, and so on. So let me give two or three examples. Marian Roberts is one of the companies that's involved in the state infrastructure program. They've just sold 100% of their shares in their construction business to a black-owned consortium. So that company is now effectively black-owned, fully black-owned, not even 50%, but fully black-owned. So there's an example where, because the state is the main, or one of the main customers, companies recognize it's helpful to them commercially that they transform. You take another example on the steel side. ArcelorMittal is a major supplier of steel to infrastructure projects. They've now announced a new BEE deal that I referred to in the presentation. So the steel that will be used will have an element of empowerment equity in it. We take the cement industry as a third example. Because it's been in the news recently, I'm quoting it, the PIC, which is the monies of many South Africans working in the public sector, have equity in a number of cement companies in the country. And so the dividend flow and the make profit go to ordinary workers working in our departments and perhaps even members of parliament. So the point really is that in many of these examples, we are seeing Black South Africans entering. Busmart, which makes the buses here in Cape Town for the My City program, that is the main shareholder, is Black South African. So I've just given a few quick examples to illustrate what is happening here. On the question raised about ITAC, we've taken note of the comments by the Auditor General. We had previously expected that the internal systems in ITAC would be improved. The Auditor General had a conversation with us to see how we can support and assist, and our hope is that by the time we get to the end of this financial year, there would be an improvement. On the organogram, the organogram has got one simple challenge. We've got an organogram that we've officially adopted. It's the legal organogram of the department. Its immediate challenge is a funding shortfall against the number of posts in the organogram. But there's a deeper and more difficult challenge which can't simply be solved by money. And that is to ask what kind of structure you need in the department. And the idea that we follow the same process as every other department, we've had to do this for a number of years because the DPSA rules are like that. But it's created a system where we've got quite a top-heavy staff structure. If you look at the average income of an employee in EDD, it is much higher than the average for the public sector as a whole. So we've got more people that are classified as specialists. But can I send them into policy development on the oceans economy or into complex area of competition law? I still have to look very much to expertise outside the department for that. So the reason is we fill posts. People apply and say, okay, the three applicants, the best of the three must be put into the post. But the fact that you're the best of the three may not mean that when you have a complex competition negotiation that you're up to the
the requirement. So it's a broader issue that the public sector zone, and I would make this thing up front, we're not attracting enough of the best skills of the society into the public sector. And so we're not going to solve it simply with National Treasury putting more money in. Of course we would want more money in. I don't want to be misunderstood. So in working with the DG, what we're saying is we need a more flexible organogram where you have a core of permanent staff, but you bring many more people from outside in on an as-need basis. We're dealing, for example, at the moment with a very complex merger phase in the financial sector. It requires a knowledge of financial markets and company structure that when this transaction is over, we won't need that again, maybe for many years. Now, if we ask one of the existing staff to do that work, it would be done at a level that won't survive legal scrutiny in a competition tribunal process. There you have top senior counsel of the country who will put our expert on the witness box, and frankly, we don't have anybody in-house that can meet that standard. So there we need to look at finding expertise from outside. In a modern 21st century organization, you need to have the ability to bring people in for the duration of that matter, have them on your staff, don't always have to be consultants at the moment, because we're trying to discourage the use of consultants, we end up without the requisite skills. A consultancy is not a long-term solution. So we've got to bring a more flexible system in. And that's what I'm encouraged by the work that the DG is doing. Up to now, what we found, the accounting officers tried to take EDD's unusual mandate and shoehorn it into the standard model of DPSA. In other words, you squeeze it in to something that it's not designed for. So I'm encouraged by the approach by the accounting office. He understands what we need to do. Whether he's going to be able to find us the people is the challenge, but he understands what you need. So we've got an organogram in place. It is being revised. The revisions that people have wanted is to say, can we move this unit to this program? That's not what I have asked. At the policy level, I've said, build us a department that is a 21st century department that can bring the top experts in the country in as the department needs them. We can't pay them long term, but we can keep them on our books for 3 months or 4 months and pay them for the 3 or 4 months. When another case comes up in a year's time that needs the expertise, we pay them again. It's that kind of different model. It's not permanent long-term employment in the same way that what we have with a standard department that monitors the building of houses or something like that. Now, even as I'm explaining, I'm sure members of parliament are curious about what it would mean for the public sector. And when I look at debates in governments all over the world, they're all beginning to confront this problem that for the innovative side of government, policy, you can't have a standard approach. So I've taken the liberty, Honourable Claire, I mean, to take your question, to go beyond your question, into what we're battling with internally, how to find a better model of how the department can respond to the needs. On the allocation of funding to CIPA, National Treasury has preferred thus far to make the money available to EDD. Their argument is that CIPA is a wholly owned subsidiary of the IEC. Its policy frame is done by the Minister of Small Business Development, but it's managed at the financial controls level by the IEC. And so Treasury's preference is the money comes to EDD, and EDD sends it to the IEC, who then manages the flow of funds to CIPA. We would be easily whether the money went to Small Business Portfolio Committee and then from there to IDC, or whether it comes to EDD and goes to IDC. We see that as essentially a postbox function. The policy oversight of CIFA lies with the Minister of Small Business Development. Honourable Pekunini, the question of protectionism is an interesting question. In 1989, when we were in the middle of our complex transition, remember the banned parties were still, well, there were a number of political parties still banned, Madiba was still in Rabla, Polsmore at the time. The rest of the world were involved in trade negotiations in something called the Uruguay Round. And the old government had become isolated diplomatically as a result of the sanctions campaign. And what they did then is they essentially used trade policy to build a bit of diplomatic support. So they started, they were told that South Africa would be classified as a developed country, and they accepted. That means that you've got less policy space to increase your tariffs. Of course, our trading partners would be like it, but it wasn't good for South Africa. By 1993, the talks had progressed very far. Binding commitments were made, and how trade talks work globally is that whoever is the authority of the day can bind not only itself, but an entire country for as long as trade agreements last. So they don't look at whether it's a democracy or not. Whoever is in charge at a given point, when they've signed, their successors in law will have to carry out those obligations. So we then were faced in late 1993 with an unpalatable set of choices. At the time, none of us were in government. I was at the time in the labor movement. And we engaged foreign governments. Remember the ANC itself, PAC, all of them were still banned when the Uruguay Round started. They were unbanned as it got to conclusion. We managed to get a special deal for the auto sector and for the clothing and textile sector, among others, through the agency of Madiba. It's a fascinating little anecdote history that on another occasion I'll tell. But as we were putting this together, the World Trade Organization announced that in May 1994, it would constitute itself as a body, and all the agreements will become binding. Now this is an important day, because just a couple of weeks before that, we had our democratic election. So while we were concerned and preoccupied with all the issues of transition, the world reached a trade deal to which South Africa was bound. Since then, so we liberalized very fast, we lost a lot of jobs in manufacturing, we decimated toy industry, the electronics industry, a significant loss of jobs in clothing and textiles, and many other sectors. Over the last 8 years, we've begun to claw back a little bit of that policy space. We found where we've got opportunity to increase tariffs, we've done it. But we've also recognized that protectionism isn't a good long-term strategy, because you put a shield around yourself, the rest of the world is out there competing, coming up with new products, coming up with new ideas, and your people pay a very high price. Yes, it's local, but it's not innovative. It's not going with the latest thinking and development. So our trade policy is not protectionism now. Neither is it free trade. It's a pragmatic case-by-case saying, look, if we increase tariffs on clothing, can it help? Maybe we can do that, but we decrease tariffs on certain products of textiles that we don't manufacture locally, so that the clothing industry can get input costs at a lower level. So there's more complexity to our trade policy, but it's a better fit for purpose policy than simply liberalizing or trying to go back into a deep protectionist mode. Neither of the two is the right approach. Cable says, huge and significant problem. Our work has been in a fairly narrow area. The first part that we've worked on as EDD is to control the export of scrap metal. It's grown massively over the last number of years. And what's happened is that there are these huge businesses that now export scrap metal to India and other Asian countries. And they provide an economic incentive for the theft of metal or cable. Because people in the township knows if you can find 10 meters of copper cable, you can take it to the scrapyard, they'll buy it quietly, no receipts will be issued, but you'll get your money in cash. They will send it to Cape Town, it will be loaded onto a ship here. So we've said part of our controls of scrap metal exports is to limit the trade in this product. The second thing that we've done is we've tried to help the rest of government to improve the laws governing scrap metal. So now, through the changes to the Criminal Matters Amendment Bill, where EDD worked with the Department of Justice, every theft of scrap metal now is a high-level offence. It's no longer core other crime. Bail conditions are tougher, and you can get up to a 20-year jail sentence. I recently looked at some of the information, and some criminals are being caught, and some are being sentenced, and some quite harsh sentences are put in. But it's my sense that it's still very much the bottom end of the food chain. So it's not your head of the syndicates that are being caught, it's your operators, your runners that are being caught. So you need better intelligence, crime intelligence, to be able to not spend all of your time mopping up the problem at the bottom. You've got to fix it at the top. So that's going to be an urgent matter that we need to deal with. On General Motors leaving South Africa, it's an interesting point, but of course investors are not going to bind themselves long term. So the best way to bind them is to ensure that we create an environment that would keep companies here, but that we also are able to mitigate when companies leave. So in the case of General Motors, in the factory that they have, there are two lines that are basically run. The one line has been run by General Motors, and the other line has been run by a company called Isuzu. And we're working now with Isuzu to see, can they expand their production and take some of the production capacity of General Motors. So that may assist, but those discussions are still ongoing. On South Korea's example, China, by the way, is the other country now building its own cars, buses, SUVs, and so on. It's been a proposal that's been around for many years. We even went for a car some years ago, an electric vehicle, that South Africa pioneered way before it became popular. But you need to have very deep pockets to get into the car making industry. It's a very competitive industry, and car making is changing dramatically as we sit here. Today, there's a lot more investment in technology for driverless cars, electric vehicles, and so on. So whether it is a good thing for South Africa to try to develop its own brand, marketed globally, remember you can't buy a car for one, you can't sell make a car for one country. You need massive global markets. So I think given our development challenges, we may want to find other products
that we pioneer instead of going to the overtrade car market and try to build a new OEM company. On the dance, I'm going to suggest that the team needs with Honorable Pikinini, someone from the PICC team, just to work through where the Honorable Member may identify what the catchment areas that can be exploited, and then we can see what the cost benefit of it is. Chairperson, I think that covers the questions that were asked in the first round, and thank you for the comments you've made about the scorecard. That, of course, will be, no doubt, come up again this afternoon in the meeting of the joint committees where the infrastructure report will be given.
I thought perhaps in terms of infrastructure maintenance, the response you've given was quite clear. However, I think we need to ensure that we bring those who really put money. I mean, conditional grant is meant for a particular purpose. And provinces, municipalities have to meet those conditions. Because it's not a grant that you can use it, you know, the way you want. You have to oblige to the conditions as given by the National Treasurer and also endorsed by the Parliament, both the two chambers of Parliament. So I still feel we are too lenient on the transgressors. We should really our foot down to make sure that those people do account for the money that they spend. I don't know what is happening. It's like people are just getting us away with the matter here. On the issue of Marion Roberts, I think everybody is pleased that there's a change of ownership in terms of the JV that has been formed and that has been the shares that have been sold. We are happy about that. But is it only about ownership? What is government doing to ensure that to sustain the ownership of us and then it makes a dent into the 10% wealthiest in the country? But it's not just about that. We'll see a market shift now. We'll see where people will now be focusing on the four main major ones and neglecting the joint venture ones now, because they still have to develop trust into this new company. And therefore still feel it's the responsibility of government to ensure that it strengthens, it empowers through local procurement and in many ways, to ensure that the status standards remain. I know that we might not have been involved in the selection of the JV. We left it to the private sector, but the fact of the matter is now that we are happy and we made pronouncements of government has been happy of the venture. Of the sale of owner of shares, then we have to do something to empower them and make them remain recognizable, one of the recognizable firms, especially at par with the rest of the companies that we all know. I'm also happy with the response I'm getting in as far as organogram and the work that the new accounting officer is doing in relation to the organogram and restructuring and the issue around the structure of the department. I'm a bit worried, Minister, here because for the past 3 years, I think we've been hearing the issue around the expertise and so forth. And the question that comes immediately to my mind is how long do we take to develop such expertise, taking into consideration the MOUs we have with the tertiary institutions. I think we should be moving forward, DG, in terms of ensuring that we don't just lament on this, but we also make sure that we contribute towards the development of such expertise. Because we do have people, it's just that they're not developed to that level. So I don't know what programs that we put in place to ensure that we empower the those with basic skills that we need so that they reach the level that we require as a department. Because it's quite clear that we have them. And I'm just I just want to also ask a policy question. Whether would we agree that I made a mistake by abandoning, softly put, the GIPSA program? Because if we had continued with it, we would have perhaps have more than what we have currently. Because we would have learned from the mistakes or shortcomings of the program then, and then built on that program so that we could fast track the development of skills in the country by using both internal resources and also external resources that we normally refer to cooperations with other countries. That is one area that I don't think we are really doing much in ensuring that we build our, we utilize external resources to build the internal. We might be getting people from outside, but they come and they still dig on our resources, go back to their country, and not leave much in our country. It's unlike us also digging from their ports and then coming back and investing more into our country. I think those are some of the issues that I thought I should just emphasize from the very clearly and ably presented responses from the minister. Unfortunately, the time will not allow for further questions. At 11:15, we should be breaking for lunch, for tea break, in preparation for the next briefing at 11:25. I had a few questions, but we have put them aside and use this opportunity really to thank the minister, the DM, and or perhaps before I do that, just give the DM a few minutes to really respond to the or talk to the question of the inclusive economy, how you contribute towards that, and maybe the minister to close up.
Just some few comments, because the minister has covered the broader areas, and also maybe chair to say that some of the things that we are raising now maybe we may have to look at one of them in the Kotala report. On that, but just to indicate that the part of the work that we're doing at the provincial level and at the local level is about responding to this matter of, let's say, investors who say we don't have local capacity. So what does that mean to an investor? It's not about having an engineering architect and so on only. It's also having a local capacity to supply, to respond to its needs. For example, I'll need a supply for this and that. Then do I have to go and then how to import it from another country? If I have a given a capacity at the local level that can give me that, it is actually better off because it doesn't bog me down into this logistics of me, establishing another the layer of bureaucracy to do that. So sometimes when you respond to skills, it's like this tangible needs skills. That is also about the capacity of the local community to be able to assist me on that. So when we deal with work at the local level, and that's why you see a lot of ministers talk about economics, about integration. You see the work that we do, we link it into training, we link it into the different opportunities that you supply development, the capacity issues around your beneficiation in the value chain and all those. It's what we try to, it's what makes you to respond to that. There is, we had an individual a week ago with higher education on Tibet. The issues that are raised here, they were also raised in that were critical and were in the area of discussion. And it was coming from both the public sector and also the industry. And they are waiting for the report to come out, but this was a leaning towards saying, have we actually come together in one space to define exactly what it is that we should do, all of us, without pointing fingers to say, government do that, and private sector do that. And we just say, this is the skills area, and why, how collectively we should actually walk into some of the things that we can prioritize. And it sounded like a very positive thing that will assist us to actually deal with the number of just one comment and two comments on two areas. One is the one that you're raising, the chair, on the capacity. Some of the capacity is not like we don't have the capacity to speak here. It's just in the nature of the work. But you know, it's in the nature of the work that we do that we don't have. If you have to have a full-time person staying, it means that you must sustain the person. We'll have a program for 3 months, and another program for 3 months, and another program for 3 months. But in the department, what we have is that we will have an intensive work that requires a 3 months work, and it dies down and it comes into the generality, which means that a person that will be there will be could be able to do some of the general work that we do. But so what you do, the capacity that the minister is talking about is an ability to identify the, in the institution the capacity that you can use to do that work in 3 months and leave that in another 3 months. If you want it in another institution, you take it from there and bring it in. That's the kind of capacity that we have. The other challenge that we have, I was listening with yesterday, I mean, this week, I think, I was listening to a program, and you know, because you were passionate about it, even putting a lot of resources in the environment around the environmental impact, the capacity in the environmental management area. The amount of money that was actually put in there, and the people that we still have in the department don't have them, they are outside. Because the more you bring that capacity inside, the more other institutions, the private sector, your NGOs take them. So as long as it's an inside capacity within the country, we don't see it as a loss, but see it as an area which is an innovative thing. You know, that's what EDG is beginning to say, that the capacity that we normally build sometimes doesn't stay with you, stays outside. But it's your capacity. See it as your capacity. Don't see it as someone else's capacity. So I think that is part of the areas that you want. The last one is on the water. On the water, water here is about its topography. So the potential of land to carry to
so what? That work has been done over the years. It's there. That's why you have been doing that has been done so many years. So it has been done. It's there. What is happening now is more the capacities that the emphasis on ensuring that capacity is harnessed for the future. But it's not only on that, it's now about the alternative process. Your mining water reclamation, your seawater desalination. So it's about that area of those. There is some areas, for instance, in the northwest. If we take an affluent estate, can we have a municipality here, a catchment? 90% of the municipalities in the northwest doesn't have that resource. So most of it is underground. So it's all the different approaches that you actually have in managing that. And I think the Department of Water is in the center of that and is assisting us in government to be able to manage that.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you to the Deputy Minister for covering some of the areas. Chair, I think on terms of consequence management is essential. I'm going to really just underline this here. On the question of transmission, there are five areas we can focus on. And they're complex to focus on them at the same time. The first one is ownership. That's clear. Ultimately, if a company is owned by a broad range of South Africans, then the benefits that flow from the economic activity is shared by all. So ownership always matters, but ownership is not enough. Second one is management. It's not the owners who drive an enterprise. The owners get the benefit of it. It's the management who has the responsibility to drive an enterprise. If you want to develop among black South Africans, the kind of high-level executive skills, they don't obtain those by being shareholders. Important the shareholding is, they obtain that by becoming top managers. You don't become a top manager by being appointed a top manager. It's the cumulative experience, the mistakes you've made, what you've learned, it's that ability to weather the storms of business, the day-to-day crises, suddenly the bank pulls your credit. You have a major order of raw material coming from elsewhere in the world and it disappears on the oceans, or it's held up at the port in Lagos, and your ability to survive that makes for the top quality management. What is a manager fundamentally? It's an organizer, it's someone who solves problems and pulls things together. So you need management. The third area that you need is workers, and that's often forgotten in the transformation debate. It can't be about the top only. You look at Germany or Sweden as examples. What's really interesting about those countries is not only that you've got good management at the top, it's that the skill levels of your ordinary production floor worker is exceptional. And the incomes that they get are great incomes. It's a badge of honor in Sweden to be an artisan. You don't have to be a lawyer or accountant. If you're an artisan, society looks up to you. You get a good pay, you've got your own little holiday house at the ocean, because it's a high-level one. It's not that they pay discriminate. It's that as an artisan, you're expected to do a lot more than an artisan may do in, say, South Africa. So the fourth one is your suppliers. They're your partners. And empowerment and transformation is also about building that supply chain. And finally, it's your community that you operate in. If you've got a major mine in an area where the community is extremely poor and people live in shacks, you will have endless resentment and challenges. So it's making progress in all five of those areas that's the measure of transformation. This is a multi-generational challenge. But in each age, we've got to do something concrete and positive in each of them. But overcoming legacies can't be done in one term or so on. But that doesn't mean there isn't an urgency to deal with issues. But it's to map that progress.
Inflation is another interesting piece of work where they're beginning to look at ownership in the economy, and they'll publish an annual monitor on that. So I think that's a helpful contribution to the debate. Chair, I was so delighted when you raised the issue of GIPSA, because too often we all have short memories. GIPSA, for colleagues who may have forgotten about it, we had the in the early 2000s, we had high growth, beginning of high growth in South Africa, but it was growth mainly fueled by a commodity boom. Mineral prices were going up, and it exposed many weaknesses in the economy. And so a twin program was launched, Asgisa on the one side and GIPSA on the other side. And GIPSA was a very interesting program, because it was a joint initiative for priority skill acquisition. And what was done is business, labor, and government were brought together, sat down in a room and said, okay, over the next 10 years, what are the skills this economy needs? And then they sat with universities and said, can you help us produce these skills? They sat with business and said, can you help to incubate these skills? By the time GIPSA was closed, because GIPSA was initially meant to be a short-term intervention, we picked up the idea of GIPSA in the new growth farm, and said that kind of work is important, and we said one whole focus of government should be on skills enhancement. Government then created something called the Human Resource Development Council, and then Deputy President Halima Motlanthe chaired it, currently Deputy President Ramaphosa chairs it, and the idea of the HRD Council is to take Chipsa's idea and institutionalize, make it permanent. So in the HRD Council, you've got a couple of trade union reps, you've got business representatives, universities and Tibet colleges are there, and government is represented both by cabinet members as well as senior staff. What we need to do is see whether the bureaucratization of the initiative has meant we're not achieving as much. In some areas, I think we're seeing the results positively. GIPSA, for example, focused on the importance of engineers as the backbone of economic growth. I've looked at the numbers, and there's clearly a much greater focus on engineering skills at universities today. We now, back in cabinet, every 3 months, we receive information on the progress with engineering graduates and artisanal graduates, so that we can see in those two key scarce skill drivers how well are we doing, where we're falling behind, and we've set ourselves targets on those. But when we're also identifying the scarce skills for the new economy, the digital economy is an area that I'm sure Honorable Atkinson, given his interest in the fourth industrial revolution, would want us to talk about, and we raised some of that in the last quarterly report of the committee. So I think it's a good moment to review the lessons of GIPSA. It was a flexible, quick response thing. We've institutionalized it. Some of it has had a positive result, but I don't think we've done enough of an evaluation whether the much more bureaucratic systems we've put in place are achieving the outcomes. So thanks, Chairperson. That may be a very nice discussion for the portfolio committee to have, together with higher education and training, economic development, and perhaps trade and industry, one or two other departments, basic education. If you bring all of us together, I would be delighted to come to a session like that, where we review the impact of skills development on economic growth and economic development. So that's on the GIPSA program. On the question of how long it takes to develop skills, I think Deputy Minister has put that very, very well. I will add this one dimension. In some of the work of the department, we need capable level of skill. But in other work of the department, we need extraordinary levels. We need some of the best capability. Example, if we have a major strike, in the platinum sector, and you take a capable, normal, competent mediator, and you send them in there, their ability to diffuse and resolve the strike is minimal. It's a complex, there's enormous political, social, economic dynamics in place. You need one of your top two or three mediators in the country to be sent in there. It's a national crisis. Now, everyone can see clearly you need top-of-class skills. In some of our work, we also have top-of-class skills that require. If we're going to design the appropriate policy intervention in the steel industry, where there are winners and losers, that you don't have an easy lever. Any lever you pull on steel has got companies that will suffer and companies that will benefit. Getting that balance right is not something that you can take a graduate from the university who's got an ordinary qualification and by exposure get in there. Then you've got to bring your top people in. So what have we done in that practical example? We set up a ministerial expert panel about a year or so ago. And we brought the chief economist of the steel industry, the CEOs of some of the largest steelmakers, including customers and suppliers. So they had tension among themselves. They were arguing different things. But unquestionably, each of those panel members knew more about the steel industry than even any academic at our top universities. The only way in which we could have trumped that is if we had brought an international consultancy firm with deep knowledge of the steel sector. With that capability that we marshaled, we were able to get insights that allowed us, in our discussion with ITAC, to ensure that the final duty structure is not deeply destructive of our steel industry. Now, that's an example of the kind of things that the terrain EDD goes in. Another example that the committee knows well, the AD-INBEV merger, we were confronted there with, at one level, just a formal amalgamation of two entities, two corporate entities, a big one swallowing the second biggest one. But sitting under that was a significant question. What is the impact of that on the South African economy? And we needed the capabilities to pull out where the opportunity for South Africa, which happened to be in this case, with bringing hops, barley, growing into South Africa and ensuring a greater level of malted products are made. Now, AB InBev has that global expertise, but they're not going to come here offering that. You need to say out of the offering of that global company, these are the levers that will help us to grow the South African economy. Now, that insight into agriculture, you're not going to be able to get as a standard thing from the ordinary agricultural economists. You need, again, deep insights. And that's the terrain we play in, that complex choices, complex opportunities, and managing all of that. So I think, Chair, what you've said, which is to build the capability skills is an important component. We need to do more of that. And then the issue that DM has raised can complement that, which is some of those skills you need to be able to pull out from the best in society. And so it's the combination of that we're looking forward to. But thank you for those comments and just for the enormous support that we constantly get from the committee. When I compare the work we do, you can see your fingerprints in the work. Sometimes a couple of years later, the committee would raise the issue of youth unemployment, and then, like today, we can point you to the 148% increase in the level of funding for youth entrepreneurs. So there may be a lag time as we get our systems going, but your comments are always very valuable. So thank you very much for this opportunity, Chair.
Thank you so much, Minister and Deputy Minister. And we really appreciate and value the relationship we have because we are partners in the work that we do. We always pride ourselves by saying we do not We are not a committee that just points fingers. We are a committee that is working jointly with our department and make sure that at all times we guide in a very positive way, and we also contribute positively in strengthening the department's work. That, in return, make sure that impacts on the lives of our people. The work that we do continues to make us proud of the interventions that the department are making or is making are felt on the ground. And, we can see that through our interaction with you and also with your parastatal. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for today's work. May we then break for tea. We'll shorten that to 10 minutes. Okay. 10 minutes break, and then when we come back, we look at the report from competition tribunal. And they're already here. Nicholas and the Russian. Oh, okay. You get it to